Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is one of my favorite authors, John Hart. John, you're also one of my favorite guests because you're easy. You're easy to interview.
Well, we've done this a few times now, D.G., and I've enjoyed every time. So I know it's going to be good, and I can just settle into it.
Well, brand new book came out last month, The Unwilling. Give us your elevator pitch, but pretend that the elevator is going all the way up to the top floor of the Empire State Building.
I got you. Okay. I think I can time that out just fine. So this is my seventh novel, The Unwilling. And I think I may have mentioned to you in an interview before that one of the things that I like to do with each book is to try to set some unique challenge for myself, to do something different that I've never done before. It's not always a definitive element of the book, but sometimes it is. The Hush was the first supernatural story I've ever written. Redemption Road was the first female protagonist I've ever written. The Last Child was an adult-themed thriller built around a 13-year-old boy. That's a pretty tough challenge. So the germ of an idea that I had when I first started kicking this novel around internally was I wanted to write something set entirely in the past. From a writer's perspective, it's a little challenging. People that read books and don't write them might not really think this part through, but one of the gifts of modern technology for novelists is the cell phone. If you have a character moving in one direction and you need to turn him left, right, or back the direction he came from, it's very easy. He gets a cell phone call, she gets a call, and there's some new information brought into the story that can propel that character into a different direction. In 1972, obviously, there was no such thing.
So this is your new book is set in 1972.
This is sort of the challenge that I wanted to undertake was to set a book in the past. So it's set in 1972. It's in Charlotte, is the setting, Charlotte, North Carolina. This is sort of a shadow of the Vietnam War era, as most people probably know. I didn't want to write a story about the Vietnam War. I wanted to write a story about the impact of the Vietnam War on people, those who fought and died there or fought and came home or the family and friends they left behind. Also a story about the young boys that grew into young men in fear of the draft and with that looming over their head. So The Unwilling comes from a quote from that era by an unnamed soldier, and it goes like this. We the unwilling, led by the unqualified, still the unfortunate, die for the ungrateful. And, I think that sums up a lot of the attitude of the, infantry soldier of that era. So I wanted that as a backdrop. And as you know, most of my stories have family elements as a backdrop, the South as a backdrop. But I write crime fiction. I mean, that's what I enjoy. I like, suspense built around foul deeds. It's a great way to explore characters and how they handle these types of situations. So the story is really about two brothers, Jason, who is older. He's mid-20s. He served three tours in Vietnam and yet came home under a dishonorable discharge and addicted to drugs and ended up in prison. And then his younger brother, Gibson, who goes by Gibby, who's 2 weeks away from graduating high school. He has a college deferment, but feels strongly that going to war is something he should maybe do. And the story begins when Jason, after 2.5 years in prison, comes home just as Gibby's approaching this pivot point in his career. And things sort of spiral out from that starting point.
Well, so you want to write in the context of the Vietnam War, but not a war novel.
Not a war novel. There was a horrible incident in the Vietnam War that is known now as the My Lai Massacre. The My Lai Massacre. It happened in 1968, I believe, when a poorly led company of U.S. soldiers, for whatever reason, went kind of insane and began slaughtering an entire village of innocent civilians. I think about 500 people were killed, women, children, without cause. There were no beefs there. There was no weaponry found. They just decided to do it. And in the middle of this massacre, a guy named Hugh Thompson Jr., who was flying a helicopter with a two-man crew, saw what was happening and put himself and his crew between these crazed troops in the village, and saved countless lives. I mean, it's been putting his own life at risk. And this was a violent confrontation. Well, the military being the military, they covered up the massacre, vilified Thompson and his crew, smeared them to try to discredit what they had been saying. A year later, a reporter named Seymour Hersh broke the story and won a Pulitzer for it in 1969. And there was a trial and national outrage, et cetera. And the rest is in the history books. But this idea of Hugh Thompson Jr. and his crew, this vision of moral, physical courage in the spite of horrible circumstances and regardless of cost, is something that's been with me for a long time. So I wanted to tell a story that had a character who, a misunderstood character who possessed those qualities. And that's the character of Jason, who's the older brother. And so there's a lot of secrecy about what he endured during the war, why he came home in disgrace, how his family receives him. The parents don't want him anywhere around. They're trying to protect this last good son in their mind. But Gibby just wants to be with his brother, and he wants to hear about the war and reconnect. And so there's a lot of that family tension. And in that first weekend Jason is back, he convinces Gibby to sneak out and go out for the day, the two of them with a couple of older women, drinking and swimming at the lake. And on the way home, on a stretch of empty road, they pass a prison transfer bus. It happens to be from the prison that Jason was just released from. And one of the girls, who's beautiful but cruel and sexual and venal and pretty much sadistic, decides it'd be fun to taunt these prisoners with a bit of a show. So she stands up in the convertible and basically causes a riot on the bus and a bloody beatdown. And the crime element of the story begins a few days later when her body is discovered savagely murdered. And suspicion turns to Jason because of his well-documented violent history. And off we go.
Well, it's fascinating. Now, back to your recollection about is it Hugh Thompson who broke up the My Lai massacre and then had to pay a price for that? Is he your model for Jason?
I don't know enough about him as an individual for him to be the model. All I know about him is that he did a very difficult thing at great risk to himself and was hounded into misery because of it. I mean, he was made the villain on the national stage, and it took 30 years for the military to finally acknowledge what he had done, and they gave him the service's highest honor for courage, not in the face of the enemy.
So one step below Congressional Medal type of award.
Yeah. Well, no, it's because he was not in violent conflict with the enemy. So I wouldn't say it's one step below.
Just a side by side. I see.
Yeah. So just, courage without actually facing the designated enemy. I mean, he was definitely at risk, but so it was more this idea of a courageous man, misunderstood, vilified for reasons that those who should care about him don't understand. What kind of person does that turn him into? What baggage does he carry? Is he a good person? I mean, does he get twisted by this experience? And then, of course, I juxtapose that with his younger brother, who's this very innocent, overly protected kid, really. And let me just sort of put a little more texture on this. So in 1972, when the novel was set, I was 7 years old. I was living in Salisbury, North Carolina. And my memories of that time are the memories a lot of us have from childhood. It was very simple, it was very innocent, playing in the creeks, riding bikes with my friends, this great childhood, just out and about without a care in the world. And yet, looking back now as an adult, I understand what a tumultuous time that was. I mean, America was torn up back then and almost as badly as it is now. We had political corruption, we had the Cold War, hot war, racial strife, riots. We weren't that far off the Kent State shootings, the prison riots at Attica. I mean, this was a tense time. So I wanted to find some way to juxtapose my recollections as a child with what I understand now about that time. And so these brothers are the reflection of that desire. Jason, the older brother, representing the conflict and tension and strife and misunderstanding and all the bad things that were going on in Gibby, this, as I said, overprotected teenager, you know, representing the rest of it. And what happens when those two things collide, you know, in a very tense situation caused by the, you know, the police investigation around the murder of this one girl and then the subsequent disappearance of the second who was in the car with them. And what happens when attention then turns to the younger brother as well. So it's, you know, it's a crime story, but built on this textured foundation of family strife, you know, the Vietnam War, you know, the tensions in the city of Charlotte. Now, I did have to enlarge the city a little bit. I dirtied it up a little bit. Charlotte did have a lot of stuff going on back in the 70s. I mean, for instance, in the book, I've got some outlaw motorcycle gangs, Hell's Angels and Pagans. And they were actually moving into Charlotte at the time. That's legitimate. There was a lot of you know, drug use in the city, some heroin and hard drugs. But, you know, I did have to make it feel a little bit bigger and grimmer than it was. But otherwise, you know, I think it worked out in a way that people would recognize.
Well, if you joined us late, I'm visiting with John Hart. We're talking about his latest book, The Unwilling, and he and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is John Hart. John Hart grew up in Salisbury, practiced law for a while on the basis of what he learned practicing law in Salisbury. He wrote a book that his first novel became a big hit. And since then, before this, well, this is his seventh. The Unwilling is your seventh book, right, John? Your seventh published book.
Yeah, number seven.
We're talking about Charlotte, North Carolina, and I mean, I shouldn't interject myself into this, but you know, I'm already interested in the period because I was living in Charlotte as a young lawyer in Charlotte in 1972. But and so you took me back to some times that I knew well, but I didn't know as well as I thought I knew, and Charlotte had some really in your book, Charlotte's. A tough place to live with, as you said, bikers, with gun dealers, drug dealers. I mean, you could get yourself into a lot of trouble in Charlotte, in your 1972 Charlotte.
Well, let me interject and just say, you know, this feeling of not knowing a place as well as you think is something I'm very familiar with, even growing up in Salisbury. I didn't truly understand how bad parts of Salisbury and Rowan County could be until I became a criminal defense attorney and started going to, you know, murder scenes at the end of these dirt roads, you know, where trailers are burned out and life is cheap and, you know, really getting into some of that criminal element. And it's stuff that I never really saw. So it was shocking for me. And that shows up a lot in my books. You know, Salisbury is kind of a fascinating place. It's got a lot of wealth and a lot of poverty, and it's a great way to storytell when you can, you know, put those two worlds side by side and, you know, mine those tensions.
I think you've talked about that with other people before, and that just hit hard home for me when you talked about being a lawyer, young lawyer, criminal lawyer, and that if you weren't, you could have spent the rest of your life in Salisbury and not known what was going on the other side of town, or out in Rowan, out in the county. And so you forced me to think, well, I was there in Charlotte in 1972. What did I miss? Why wasn't I out and about learning about the dark side of living in Charlotte? It came.
You're probably a little smarter than I am, DG.
I hope the folks who are listening will forgive me for taking this away for just a second, but my family and I went to church in a dark side of Charlotte down in what was called Piedmont Courts at that time, but it was a public housing project like Earl Village, which you I think you reference in your book. But you know, we went to church and everything seemed fine. And then I read another book about this drug dealer that just came out, who, while we were going to church, he was over there dealing drugs and in dark circumstances in Piedmont courts. And even though I was there, I never saw the underside of what was going on right before my eyes. So you opened the door for me to look back at my life and say, what else did I miss about where I was? And those of us who live in Chapel Hill now, there's some of us who've never seen the dark side of Chapel Hill and the surrounding area. But there are dark sides to wherever we are. John, thank you. And those of you who are listening, we're going to get back to John's book now. Jason is one of your main characters, and he's complicated. But basically, I think you intend for him to be a good human being. But there is another character, maybe the most interesting character in your book, who is definitely, you could call him a number one evil guy. Tell us about X.
Well, I'm going to speak briefly to Jason and into X, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
I had so much fun writing this character of Jason because for the most of the book, there is a distinct ambiguity about how he should be perceived. I mean, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? I mean, with any character, as a novelist writes the story, you know, we do these information drops through action, dialogue, flashback, whatever that informs the character. And most often, with most characters, your understanding of that character only grows as the story progresses.
Let me just interrupt you in case somebody joined us late. Jason, the character John is talking about, is comes back from Vietnam as a soldier. He did some heroic things, but got into trouble that he didn't earn, but he came back and became a drug addict and went to jail and got into arms dealers and bikers and everything else. So he's a complicated guy. You try to say, is he bad or he's good? He'd done some really good things, and he'd gotten into some really bad trouble. So this is Jason that you're telling us about. And so I think the question you're dealing with is he bad or is he good? Is he a good guy?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he's a dangerous, complicated fellow, and he doesn't give away much. And he's so pigeonholed by the people that think they know who he is, you know, his parents, the police, all the people that know his history. And so I had a lot of fun with him because the reader doesn't really understand who Jason is until near the end of the novel. And I think that it comes as a revelation, which was really satisfying for me because bearing in mind that I did base him on this, you know, the actions of this very heroic guy back in Vietnam, Hugh Thompson Jr., it's the best characters are incredibly complex, but in believable ways where possible. Right. And I'm going to use that turn of phrase to segue into this other character you're talking about, X, because X is probably the most over-the-top character I've ever written. I wanted him for the story. He's not entirely believable, but I think in the world of the story, if you give me just the slightest grace, you can buy into him. So let's talk about that for a minute. X, we meet in prison. I describe him in some of my interviews as the most dangerous man alive, and I think that's a fair description. He's on death row, awaiting execution for the murder of 69 victims that are known about. As it turns out, he's not exactly on death row. When we meet him, he's living in the sub-basement beneath death row. He's got a suite of cells. There are about six cells that are all empty except for X and his possessions. And he eats well and he paints and he exercises a penchant for violent behavior. But what makes him so fascinating is the fact that he's also insanely wealthy, and he uses this wealth to lever actors outside of his immediate control. I mean, he's got people inside the prison that do his bidding, people outside of the prison that do his bidding. He's this brilliant, unpredictable, basically unknowable force who does things for his own reasons, and for reasons that are not immediately understood, has a bit of a fascination with this character, Jason. You know, Jason served 27 months in the same prison. X came to admire Jason because of his capacity for violence. And let me just paint a picture here. X is he's bored. He's biding his time until his execution. And one of the things he really likes to do is go fisticuffs with the most violent felons available in the prison. And the warden makes these inmates available to him. And so he exercises his passion for violence down in the sub-basement, you know, fighting the worst that the prison can offer. And eventually we learn Jason finds himself in that unenviable position of having to go toe-to-toe with a guy who's exquisitely trained in violence. And yet this relationship, I call it a one-sided relationship, blossoms where, you know, X sees in Jason something he never expected to find, which is by his definition an equal. And so the relationship that evolves between them and the actions that flow from that relationship and the motivations that lead to some of the you know, crime elements, the murders, et cetera, were a lot of fun to write and very different from anything I've ever done before. But, you know, again, we talked earlier about setting challenges in each novel, or, you know, a challenge as a writer. What is something I can try that I've never done before? And I've always enjoyed, as I think many have, the character of Hannibal Lecter. I mean, he was just so compelling and evil and believable and yet larger than life. And that's a hard thing to do, and not many people can pull it off. And Thomas Harris is certainly one of them. I mean, Silence of the Lambs, Red Dragon, I mean, just fantastic explorations of that kind of twisted psyche. So I really wanted to see if I could do the same sort of character, a little over the top, but make him believable in the world of the book. And yet,
John, let me interrupt you briefly, because although in my generation, everybody knows who Hannibal Lecter is, there may be some people who are listening, but to remind us, he was he's the guy who ate his victims.
Yeah, it's and, funny, you know, I forget how old I am too. So this was made most popular in the movie with
Jodie Foster
and Anthony Hopkins. And Anthony Hopkins played Hannibal Lecter, who was in the story, a brilliant psychologist who, unbeknownst to his patients or anyone else, took great pleasure in killing and eating certain people that spoke to him for reasons that only he understood. But because he was rendered as this brilliant psychopath, I mean, he's one of these guys, as horrifying as he was, it was very difficult to take your eyes off of him.
John, let's take a quick break. When you come back, I'm going to ask you the question, was it your objective to make X outdo Hannibal Lecter as an evil character? That's the question we'll put for you before John Hart, the author of the new book, The Unwilling, after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with John Hart, the author of The Unwilling, his seventh book in a series of very successful and different books. And John, I interrupted you before we took the break. We were talking about the connection between Hannibal Lecter, the star of Silence of the Lamb, a main character in Silence of the Lamb, the psychiatrist or doctor whose victims he enjoyed eating after he. Well, so I'm suggesting that John Hart, our guest, set out to design a character who not only competed with Hannibal Lecter for being the most interesting and worst evil character, but he wanted to. I'm asserting, John Hart, that you wanted X, your character in The Unwilling, to be even more evil and entertaining and enticing than Hannibal Lecter. Was that your objective?
Actually, no, because I don't think that's possible. I hope to rival Hannibal Lecter is a character. You know, he is so perfectly drawn in the books and also in the movies. I mean, I think that, or at least in the first movie, he got a little bit too much in the second one they made. But, you know, just for what he is, for that type of, you know, vicious, psychopathic, brilliant, sadistic killer, I mean, he's just absolutely perfect. And so I honestly think it's impossible to surpass him. But I did want to make a character that was reminiscent of him, equally as compelling, and equally believable. And that is the challenge, because, you know, any character like that is so beyond the experience of normal human beings. We really can't imagine that such a person could ever exist. And yet, of course, I suspect they have. I mean, probably the finest killers out there are the really brilliant ones who have never been discovered, you know, even suspected. And I have to believe that those people are out there. It's a big world and it's full of some really twisted people. So, I like doing contrasts of characters. And so this character of X, in contrast to Jason, X is capable of great violence because he likes it, and thrives on it. Jason is equally capable, but only because he was forced to be capable through his time at war and what he learned on those three tours in Vietnam. So, you know, one fights for pleasure, the other for survival, and it creates this really unique bond between them. But, you know, X, I will say, you know, I don't want to say he's completely over the top, because I believe in the confines of the story he works, but he is larger than life. And the reaction to him has been interesting. Many folks that read this book have absolutely loved everything about him. They think he's one of the best evil guys they've ever read. In fact, I won't name names, but one of the top guys in publishing, and I mean even on an international scale, you know, said that he's one of the, you know, well, he said this was in the two top thrillers he's ever read, and he's published thousands of them.
Well,
and I
well.
Think the reason he felt that way was because of this character X. You know, in fact, his immediate comparison was to Hannibal Lecter. So, you know, I always enjoy it when I feel like I've achieved what I set out to do. I mean, heck, we all do. And writing a novel, it takes so much time and there's so much doubt involved. It's impossible to know if one succeeds until the book has been out long enough to get that kind of critical feedback. So I'm comfortable saying now that I think I achieved it. But, you know, it's a challenge and it's fraught with uncertainty in the making of it.
Well, John, talk a little bit more about this challenge that you had to draw a character that could compete with Hannibal Lecter. And where did you get your model and your ideas? You didn't just make him up entirely, did you? I mean, you had some models of X-type characters, or is it totally a figment of your imagination?
Well, no, I mean, the models are out there. The archetypes are out there. I mean, Hannibal Lecter is you know, the pinnacle of that. But there are loads of books and movies that have explored these types of guys, right? And, you know, I never wanted this to be a serial killer book, right? I mean, that's why I make it about family and place and normal people. It's mostly about those people. And all of my books have been about the effect of evil on relatively normal people, and how they then find the will, strength, courage to confront whatever this darkness is. And I think you can see that in every book I've written. It's a fascinating study for me, and it's what makes writing characters so fun and engaging for the readers, because it's, you know, we read about these situations and we understand these characters and can't help but ask what would we do in similar circumstances. And I think that that's part of what, you know, good fiction is. I don't know who started this, but for some time now, my books have been described as literary thrillers. And I've always had mixed feelings about that, because I'm a storyteller first and a bit of an escapist by nature. So when I hear, you know, literary thrown in front of thriller, I'm not sure I feel about that. But what I've come to believe is that that word is used because the characters that I create are generally fleshed out and understandable to the point that they feel very real. And that's about all of the things that we need in order to understand the actions in the world that I've created. For instance, you know, what truly motivates these characters. And the same thing can be said of X. So one of the sort of, I don't know, tenets that I adhere to in creative writing is that most of the things that inform who we are as adults, and thus the characters that I write, are things that happen to us in childhood. These don't have to be horrible things. They can be, but they can be transformative things in other ways, good, bad, or indifferent. So it's really about creating people that are vibrant because the reader understands why they are who they are in the book. And it's doubly important with someone like X because he is so larger than life and impossible to relate to in any real meaningful way. So I put a lot of thought into writing, you know, his backstory and what made him the way he was. And, you know, I think that what we don't often see is this idea of a Hannibal Lecter type character, a really intelligent serial killer who just happens to come from one of the wealthiest families in the world. And what added level of power or invisibility or depravity is he capable of given that vast wealth? And so, you know, I really had to build him carefully. But again, he's not the heart of the book by any stretch. The two brothers that I talked about, the family dynamic, you know, the impact of the war, I would say that's more
central. Well, I want to talk about some of your other characters. These are not the only characters you introduce us to. So let's take a quick break. And after the break, John Hart and I will talk more about The Unwilling and talk about some of the other interesting characters who are part of this brand new book. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with John Hart. John Hart's a friend of many people here in Chapel Hill. He went to school here for a while, but grew up in Salisbury. And although John lives in Virginia now, every one of his books, John, correct me if I'm wrong, is set in North Carolina. And this latest one is set largely in Charlotte, North Carolina, during 1972, and we talked about some of the major characters. But you've always got young teenage people searching. You could still call them children, and you've introduced us to Gibson. But one of the most interesting characters for me was Chance, Gibby's best friend, young, innocent, a little bit naive, good person, but you put him into trouble situations. Tell us about Chance and where he came from.
Well, so, you know, what we've talked about up to this point has made the book sound like a very hard story, right? We've got Vietnam and survivors of the war and this crazy killer living in the basement under death row and all these horrible things. But the book is so many things. And part of what this book is a coming of age story. And, you know, there are three characters that really embody this. One is Gibby. As I mentioned earlier, he's 2 weeks away from high school graduation. He's Jason's younger brother. And basically the only one that thinks Jason is not capable of the murder of this one woman we discussed earlier. And then his best friend Chance, and then his budding love interest, young girl named Becky, from the wrong side of the tracks, you could say. She's, you know, dirt poor. In fact, Chance is dirt poor. And Gibby comes from wealth. And again, this is sort of this have-not friction that I really enjoy in some of these books. So Gibby, you know, he is... he's not fearless by any stretch, but he is a believer in obligation and duty. And so he is very willing to go to Vietnam. He does have a college deferment, but he spends some of his time, or in fact, a lot of his time, debating whether to enlist because, you know, his brothers fought in Vietnam. One died there. His father was a Marine in Korea. He feels like there's this duty, this call of duty. Chance, on the other hand, who is being raised by a single mom and living in a poor home on the wrong side of town, lives in secret horror of the war. Now, Chance, by all outward appearances, is fearless. I mean, he'll fight any guy, try for any girl, but it's all a mask to cover up this, I call it the secret of his schoolboy shame. And it's this abiding terror of going to Vietnam. He hoards these magazines filled with images of horrible death, and he keeps them in a box under his bed. And it's Again, the secret of his schoolboy shame, this deep abiding terror. So those kids, I think, represent a lot of what I remember older kids in fear of the draft. I mean, this was not a stretch for me. But because I wanted some soft elements in the book, I introduced this character, Becky, that, Gibby has been in love with secretly forever and a day, and finally realizes in this book that she's interested in him as well. And so it's very much a young love, you know, awkward kind of thing, but beautiful, I think, in the telling. I had a lot of fun writing those relationships. And of course, what they become is a group of friends caught up in these horrible circumstances, surrounded by death, hunting for the person responsible. And then, of course, Gibby becomes a suspect, so he's on the run, and his friends are trying to help him, and at the same time, they're horrified by what he's trying to accomplish. It was just, I don't know. I mean, again, as I said earlier, this book is equal parts an exploration of the innocence of childhood in the 70s, contrasted with the complexities of that very difficult time and all the violence and fear and rage and misunderstandings.
And John Hart, contrast. I mean, only you would insert into a otherwise book full of horrors and horrible people a budding, innocent, young love affair. And you pull it off. You make it a part of the story. But that was a challenge, wasn't it?
Well, no, it wasn't that much of a challenge. You know, it's just a deliberate path that I chose to pursue. It's important to remember that this book is, it is equal parts crime fiction, family drama, coming of age story, and serial killer book. And so that's it sounds like a lot of moving parts, but it's possible to weave them together in a nice fashion. And I needed this kid, Gibby, to have reasons for hope and for the readers to understand that, he's not caught up just in the nightmare, but that, there is this, this embrace of friendship, both from Becky and Chance, that he, he's not alone in dealing with it. Because, look, this is the way life is. There are times we feel horribly alone. There are times we feel surrounded and loved. And it's important to recognize that, especially in fiction.
Well, the other part of it, gosh, we don't have time to really probe, but just mention that Gibby's parents are complicated, and their relationship with Gibby is also complicated, as is the family's relationship with Jason, the troubled but heroic guy who comes back from Vietnam. So you've not only got a budding love story, you've got a family and great challenges all woven in the story of your crime fiction story, I guess.
I'll just touch very briefly on the parents, Gabrielle and Bill French. The dad is a murder cop, has been for 30 years. He married above himself, he would tell you. His wife is from a wealthy family, lovely, educated. Yet she is shattered when her favorite son is killed early in the war, comes home in a box. His twin brother overhears her one night professing her wish that it had been the surviving twin who had died and not the one who was actually killed, because the dead one was always her favorite. And so in a fit of confusion, anger, et cetera, he decides to enlist because he can't possibly stay in that house. And he lives, but comes back unknowable. And in the interim, all that this woman has done is smother this one last son, her baby boy, and in a way that the kid can't stand. So it's a problem.
Well, John, there are other wonderful, I don't want to call them side ventures because they all get woven into the story, but a remarkable compilation of crime fiction, of family, of growing up, coming of age, I guess is what we call it. And all of this comes together so that many critics do call your work literary fiction. So if a listener is thinking about getting just another beach read, maybe this is not the book for them, but if they're willing to deal with more of the complexities of what life is really about, it might be a challenging but also rewarding book. Thank you for writing it and for sharing more with us, more about it today. Before we stop, John, a lot of people are wondering, those of us who've got caught up with John Hart tries something new in every book. What are you going to try new in the next book?
Well, it's funny, you know, this may be the first time I don't actually try something new. The book I'm writing now is actually a sequel to Redemption Road.
Oh, wow. Oh, really?
Yeah. So that was the first female protagonist I've ever written. And I really loved her. She was just fantastic. I mean, I went into that with a great sense of dread, fear, and, you know, and responsibility to get it right, because so many of my readers are women and they're smart, and there are so many ways I thought to ruin a female character writing it as a man. But, you know, I'd probably be accused of some kind of appropriation now. But
have you got a title for the book? Got a title for the book?
The working title is Beyond Redemption, you know, sequel to Redemption
right.
Road.
And what's the character? I can't remember the name of that great character.
Yeah, sure. Her name was Elizabeth Black. She was the, you know, daughter of a preacher who became a cop in a small southern town. And when we last saw her, she was on the run with her boyfriend who was accused of murder. So she fled her duties as a police officer and fled the state with an ex-convict wanted for murder and two young children, 17 and 14, that sort of were, you know, drawn into her tow during the course of the book. Well, so they're living on the run when the book opens.
Wow. Well, John Hart, I can't wait to read it, and I hope you'll sit right back down after this and go finish it up so we can be reading it in a time within the next year or two. In the meantime, thank you, John Hart, for your new book, The Unwilling, and thanks for sharing so much of it with us here today.
My pleasure, DJ. I always enjoy this conversation. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all you for listening. This is DG Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.